From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Yeah, both Iraq and USA have learned from the past, and the Iraqis will be fully cooperative, and the U.S. is unlikely to use U.N. inspectors for espionage.
Today, a conversation with Dilip Hero, author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, and another book, War Without End. But first, the second highest-ranking Senate Republican calls for Trent Lott's ouster. We'll go to Jackson, Mississippi, to learn about a protest that will be held outside his office today. And another country lurches to the fundamentalist religious right. The Hindu Nationalist Party has won in a landslide victory in the state of Gujarat. A citizens' tribunal recently concluded the leader of the party perpetrated the riots that left 2,000 people dead, most of them Muslim. We'll go to India. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Washington, the second-ranking Republican in the Senate, Don Nichols of Oklahoma, has become the first Republican senator to call for Trent Lott's ouster as party leader. Lott sparked an outcry last week after he said the U.S. would have been a better place if the candidate Strom Thurmond had been elected president in 1948 when he ran on the slogan, Segregation Forever. Under Senate Republican rules, Nichols would need the support of four other senators to convene a meeting to consider Lott's fate. Nichols talked numerous times with outgoing National Republican Senatorial Committee Chair Bill Frist of Tennessee, who reportedly shares many of Nichols' concerns. Frist is a close ally of Bush and a possible candidate for Lott's position himself. We'll have more on that story in just a few minutes. In other Washington news, Al Gore announced last night he would not run for the president in 2004. The New York Times is reporting that the Pentagon may begin using the U.S. military to begin conducting covert propaganda operations friendly in neutral countries. Under the proposal, the military might pay journalists to write stories favorable to American policies or hire outside contractors without obvious ties to the Pentagon to organize rallies in support of U.S. policies. The White House has begun searching for a new chair and vice chair of the commission to investigate the September 11th attacks. This comes after the resignations last week of Henry Kissinger on Friday and former Senator George Mitchell. Kissinger had concluded he could not serve on the committee if he had to disclose the clients of his private firm, Kissinger Associates. Newsweek is reporting that several of his clients had heavy investments in Saudi Arabia, including Boeing and ABB Group, a Swiss-Swedish engineering firm. Among those being talked about as replacements are former Senator John Danforth, former Secretary of State George Shultz, and former Senator Bob Dole. Dole also spoke at the tribute for Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday. The Arabic television station Al Jazeera and Turkish TV are reporting that 50 U.S. military trucks have entered northern Iraq and that 500 U.S. special forces are training around 2,000 Kurds. The Pentagon has denied the report. Meanwhile, the London Observer is reporting that dozens of teams of elite U.S. soldiers and intelligence specialists have been sent into Iraq with millions of dollars in cash to persuade key tribal leaders to revolt or stop cooperating with Saddam Hussein. The secret campaign, based on tactics used in Afghanistan last year, has been underway for several weeks. And at the United Nations, Iraq is urging the global community to stop a, quote, undeclared war waged by U.S. and British warplanes policing their self-declared no-fly zones. In a letter sent Iraq Foreign Minister Naji Sabri wrote, quote, these daily violations facilitated by the government of Kuwait and the barbaric bombing of Iraq cities and villages have reached the level of an undeclared war. The no-fly zones have never been authorized by the United Nations. In Venezuela, President Hugo Chavez has said he will consider resigning if violence and economic turmoil make the nation ungovernable. But he said this will not be necessary because the worst of the 14-day national strike seeking to drive him from office has passed. On Friday, the United States openly sided with Chavez's political opponents by calling for early elections. It was the strongest statement from the Bush administration since April, when the White House endorsed a military-led coup against Chavez by recognizing the interim government that temporarily replaced him. For the first time since the Supreme Court reinstated capital punishment in 1976, the number of death row prisoners has decreased. The death row population fell just slightly from 3,601 in 2000 to 3,581 in 2001. And in New York, a massive strike by bus and subway workers has been put off for now. Union officials said there is enough progress in contract talks to postpone the threatened strike, which was to begin earlier today at midnight.
You give me second-class houses and second-class schools. Do you think that all colored folks are just second-class fools, Mr. Backline? I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue. When I try to find a job to earn a little cash, all you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round, and it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige, and brown, Mr. Backlash. I'm gonna leave you with a backlash blue.
Nina Simone singing Backlash Blues here on Democracy Now! Republican Senator Don Nichols of Oklahoma has become the first Republican senator to ask his colleagues to consider replacing Trent Lott as the party's leader. Nichols is the second-ranking Republican in the Senate behind Trent Lott, and according to the New York Times, has long had designs on Lott's job. Lott sparked an outcry last week after he said the United States will be a better place if Strom Thurmond had been elected president in 1948 when he ran behind the slogan Segregation Forever. Under Senate Republican rules, Nichols would need the support of four other senators to convene a meeting to consider Lott's fate. Over the weekend, Republican supporters of Lott tried to assure Lott's survival, a Senate Republican leader. They dispatched allies to TV and radio talk shows and planned appearances for Lott before African-American groups. But the conservative New York Post called for Lott to step down, and the Sunday New York Times ran an in-depth story on Lott's segregationist career. Lott was head of his fraternity at the University of Mississippi. He made the cheerleading squad and became known for carrying the school banner, the Confederate battle flag, onto the field at football games. Lott fiercely opposed integration at his university, known as Ole Miss. Lott's mother wrote a letter to the editor of the newspaper who was denouncing racial violence and anti-integration efforts. She wrote, quote, "You are truly an integrationist, and I hope you not only get a hole through your office door, but through your stupid head." Trent Lott also helped lead the Southern opposition to the integration of his fraternity, Sigma Nu. After graduation, Lott worked for the Mississippi Congressmember William Comer, one of Washington's staunchest segregationists and opponents of civil rights. Lott's duties included responding to mail. In July 1969, Justine Strange wrote, "Mississippi is no more thanks to our politicians. We are slave to the guerrilla race. Our proud white race is now in the servitude to the NAACP Jews and Negroes." Lott politely replied he was, quote, not insulted by her letter, but added, quote, "I was just disappointed that you were not more appreciative of my efforts in behalf of sound government and against the things you complained of." We go now to Jackson, Mississippi, where Stephanie Parker Weaver will soon be joining a number of other people outside the office of Trent Lott in Jackson for a protest. Stephanie Parker Weaver is Executive Secretary of the Mississippi branch of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
Can you talk about while you be outside of the offices of Trent Lott today?
Well, one of the things that we've noticed is that there has been a lot of the national expressions of outrage by different national leaders and different talk show hosts and what have you. And one of the ingredients that has been missing has been the local opposition. And so we are beginning our efforts on today to organize and mobilize the community of conscience to ensure that Senator Lott steps down. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about his record in Mississippi? I mean, we have gone through a number of times over the last week how, as a congressman in 1978, he was behind the successful effort to reinstate the citizenship of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. In 1981, Lott prodded the Reagan administration into taking the side of Bob Jones University and other segregated private schools that were suing the IRS to restore tax exemptions withdrawn a decade earlier because of the school's discriminatory racial policies. In 82 and 90, Lott voted against extending the Voting Rights Act. In 83, he voted against the national holiday of Martin Luther King, among other stands he has taken.
Well, I think that you pretty much summed up what his pattern and practice has been over the years. Those of us in Mississippi clearly recognize that Lott is not a friend or a staunch supporter of any of our issues that affect the black community, a minority community, poor people, women, and workers. And so, you know, what Senator Lott has done has really opened up an opportunity for those of us who care about America and moving America forward to begin to talk about the very touchy subject of race. We're in the middle of a terrorist war, and we're about to send our children off to war. And so we cannot have a nation that is divided along race, along party, or what have you. What we have to do is to have a united front. And what Lott has done has opened up that divide, that racial divide, and hopefully we can get it resolved as soon as Lott goes back to the House to Pascagoula, Mississippi.
We have heard Senator Lott issue apologies for perhaps being misinterpreted, and then Friday, the strongest apology, the first time he held a news conference in Mississippi, saying how he had supported his state. Can you talk about what his role has been in Jackson, where you are? I know that Stephanie Parker Weaver, you were on the front page of the New York Times a couple months ago, having to do with Nissan case, which Trent Lott played a role in.
Yeah, well, he was instrumental in bringing Nissan to Mississippi, to Canton, Mississippi, which is about 8 or 10 miles from the capital city. However, that's not indicative of what he has done for the metro community or those other communities, particularly like the Delta, where it is majority black, where there are majority black citizens. The coast has benefited from his largesse or his influence. However, when you look at the where the rubber meets the road, there has not been the kind of economic development packages, the kind of infrastructure, the kinds of jobs that have come to areas, the poor areas of the state of Mississippi, that Trent Lott has had an opportunity to influence legislation to ensure that we were that we got off the bottom. And so it is in Lott's inability to relate to the downtrodden, to the African American community, that we find such a void in his public life, and particularly in his private life as well. And so we are coming together in Mississippi to say loudly and strongly that what Senator Lott did, and even in his apology, he still doesn't get it. I mean, Senator Lott was not only he was way off base for what he said, however, he must have felt that he had a base of support from which to stand. And therein lies the problem. He doesn't even realize, he doesn't realize what he did and the harm that it has done. You know, somebody once said that a gaffe is when a politician tells the truth, and a super gaffe is when a politician says what he really thinks. And Senator Lott committed a super gaffe. And so he obviously let his hair down, let his guard down, and he must have thought he was standing in front of the Council of Conservative Citizens or some other supporter or person who leans towards the Ku Klux Klan or something for him to make the kind of atrocious, offensive, insulting, racist statement that he made. Everybody with good sense realizes that the nation would not be better off in 1948 if it had elected Strom Thurmond. That's certainly not the truth.
And so who is gathering for the protest today in Jackson?
Members of the Mississippi NAACP, SCLC, local minister.
Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Southern Christian Leadership Conference, founded by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of which Senator Lott voted against making Dr. King's birthday a national holiday, saying basically, well, it costs too much and there's more people, there are others out there who are more deserving of a national holiday, you know, that kind of thing. But local ministers, community activists, labor union persons, women, and so this is just the beginning of the mobilization effort. And until he resigns, steps down, or is forced out, then we'll continue to protest and to let our voices be heard locally here, because the national audience and the people across this country are equally outraged, and rightly so.
Well, Stephanie Parker Weaver, I want to thank you very much for being with us. My last question is, the record that we're talking about is one that has spanned decades for Trent Lott. Does it surprise you now to hear people talking about him as the segregationist supporter, considering this is a pretty clearly laid out record of the past 20 years?
Well, what
30?
What? I'm not surprised. It's just, you know, there are those of us in the enlightened community who have always been aware. But, you know, oftentimes you find yourself out there as a lone ranger, you know, and people try to isolate you when you highlight records of persons like Trent Lott. And so what has happened now is that the scales may have been removed from the eyes of the masses. And it is always a good thing when persons can recognize that they may have been blinded because of sometimes their own issues. But now that it has been clearly revealed, we're not looking at this through rose-colored glasses or even through a prism. It is very clear what Lott is, who he is, and what he stands for.
Stephanie Parker Weaver, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Secretary of the Mississippi Southern Christian Leadership Conference, speaking to us from Jackson, Mississippi. As we move across the world right now to India, where the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party has won a landslide victory in the western state of Gujarat after what the London Guardian calls the most contentious election campaign in modern Indian history. The ruling BJP party has now a two-thirds majority in the new state assembly. The sweep is a huge victory for Gujarat's controversial leader, BJP member Narendra Modi. Earlier this year, he presided over the worst riots in India for a decade. Nearly 60 Hindus were killed on a train in Gujarat last February. Reprisal killings of Muslims convulsed the state for weeks. In the bloody month of March, armed Hindu mobs targeted Muslim-owned homes and businesses across Gujarat, raped and killed hundreds of women, and burned Muslim men alive. Police and state officials stood by and watched. By the time the state finally took control of the mobs, over 150,000 people had lost their homes and at least 2,000 people were dead. Dozens of human rights reports have indicted the Gujarat chief minister, Modi, and his government for complicity in the reprisal killings of Muslims. Last month, a citizens' tribunal led by former Indian High Court judges concluded that last spring's attacks were, quote, an organized crime perpetuated by the state's chief minister and his government. Leading up to this weekend's elections, Modi campaigned repeatedly invoking the deaths of Hindus in the riots. Campaign posters plastered across the state depict him beside a burning railway car. At one campaign stop, he roared, "Merchants of death, you are killing people. You are attacking our country. We will not leave you. We will not give you any space in Gujarat." The firebrand International General Secretary of the World Hindu Council declared Sunday, "Gujarat is the graveyard of secular politics." He said in 2 years, India will be a pure Hindu nation. We go first to former Democracy Now! Producer Miranda Kennedy, who is now reporting from Gujarat. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Miranda.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Good to be with you.
Can you talk about...
Well, the World Hindu Council says that it's the graveyard of secular politics. Many people here believe that it's the graveyard of democracy and that Gujarat now signals a new spell in Indian politics. It's a very strange mix here of complete jubilation in many Hindu areas and total desolation in the Muslim ghettos. Yesterday, all over Gujarat, as the results came out, the Muslims retreated to their ghettos, terrified of attacks, and the streets of most Muslim districts were completely deserted. But in several areas, as BJP processions went by, violence erupted with local Muslims. Two people were killed last night in such incidents, and in the city of Baroda, which is not far from Ahmedabad, which is where I am, 12 people were injured when riots erupted during a victory rally and shops were set on fire across the city. And now the area is under an indefinite curfew. There's more than 100,000 paramilitary and riot police who have been dispatched across the state during the polling period, and thousands of men were arrested preemptively to prevent violence last week as Gujarat went to the polls. But now that the government has taken control and the election period is over, Muslims are wondering who's going to protect them. In one of the Muslim areas of Ahmedabad, which is hit hardest by the violence, more than half of the residents have moved out before the results were announced. They stayed to vote for Congress, and they left, fearing a BJP victory. And yesterday, as the results became clear, I went to the last remaining refugee camp in Ahmedabad, which is for victims who lost their homes in last spring's violence. That's about 150,000 Muslims lost their homes. And this refugee camp is ironically only a few streets away from the BJP headquarters. There, the organizer of the camp told me there is no future for Muslims in India, especially not in Gujarat. Even after all the wrong the BJP has done to us, he said, they win with such a clear majority. It means that something is wrong with the people of Gujarat. And I think that he's not alone, but the headquarters of the BJP in Ahmedabad were insane yesterday. The BJP supporters were going wild. I think that the BJP was even shocked by its landslide victory. It wasn't just Muslims and secular activists who are shocked, but the BJP expected to win, but by a smaller margin. So they were throwing confetti and vermilion powder and letting off endless rounds of firecrackers and thronging around each of the winning candidates as they arrived into the office, handing out victory sweets. And when Chief Minister Narendra Modi arrived, his supporters chanted, "Hindus forever, and Modi is our leader." But just across the street, ironically, a group of men were sitting there, because the BJP headquarters is actually in a Muslim district. So this group of Muslim men are sitting quietly, and they said to me, "Our new government is the same men who attacked our communities and burned our homes. How can we trust them?" And I think that that spells a lot of the feeling of Muslims around Gujarat today.
Well, Miranda, I want to thank you very much for being with us from Gujarat. When we come back, we're going to speak to the senior editor at the Hindustan Times, a social activist based in Delhi, as well as the director of the Women's Action Group in Ahmedabad, the largest city in Gujarat. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Why have I decided?
Constant fear, paranoia, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to two people, Sheba George is director of Sarwaru, a women's organization based in Ahmedabad, the largest city in Gujarat, and Amit Sengupta is senior editor at Hindustan Times in Delhi. First, I want to talk about the overall significance of this BJP victory in Gujarat, Amit Sengupta in the country's capital, Delhi.
Hello, yeah.
Hi. First,
Hello,
the significance.
Can you repeat the question?
Yes, first, the significance of this victory for all of India.
No, it's a strange dilemma for India for the largest democracy in the world that people who have used a very sectarian and highly vicious anti-minority card. And who have defended the killings of and rapes of innocent people in openly and publicly, and who have fielded candidates who were actually leading the mobs who were participating in this orgy of violence, they have been elected. So while the nation accepts the verdict as a democratic verdict of the people, it is also a sense of dilemma and a paradox that where is the country going to?
Where do you think it's going to?
I think the country will not go the Gujarat way. And this is based on the optimism of the essential tolerance of Hinduism, the strong secular dimensions which our young democracy has, you know, believed in since independence from the British, and that despite so many efforts in the last 15 years by the BJP and the right-wing fronts, of the BJP, which can be compared to the, maybe the KKK of the Western US, or also it can compare to the extreme right-wing sectarian Islamists, you know, in Afghanistan or Pakistan. Because I guess the people who will be most happy with this kind of a hardline victory in Gujarat will be the mullahs and the Islamists, because this will polarize the larger political scenario into these kind of extremist formations. Whereas I'm sure most Indian Muslims and most liberal Hindus and most Hindus do not subscribe to either this kind of a version of Hinduism, which is aggressive, militant, violent, anti-minority, xenophobic, and the kind of, you know, larger, tolerant, pluralist, multicultural, multilingual, democratic Hinduism, which is part of the national ethos.
Given that the national government is BJP, why is this such a surprise that Gujarat would go that way?
I can't understand.
National government is BJP, why is this such a surprise that Gujarat would vote this way?
Why Gujarat was?
Why is it such a surprise that Gujarat would vote BJP?
Gujarat was very crucial for BJP because it was supposed to be called the BJP's lab. That is the lab of the right-wing Hindutva. Hindutva means the extreme dimension of Hinduism, which is based on anti-minority politics. And Gujarat was some kind of a laboratory for them for the last 10 years. If you remember, there were a couple of years ago a sustained campaign against Christians in the tribal areas, which is called the Dangs in Gujarat. And several attacks on, you know, churches, which are essentially very poor churches. Bibles were burnt, Christians were attacked. On Christmas, they built up a huge anti-Christian kind of congregation. And then an Australian missionary called Graham Staines and his two sons who was working with lepers, leprosy mission in a state called Orissa, was burnt alive by Bajrang Dal, which is part of this larger family called the Sangh Parivar, of which BJP is the political parliamentary group. And this has been a kind of a sustained kind of a politics, which, you know, the Indian media would till some time ago call as the lunatic fringe. But now, as things are becoming clear, the lunatic fringe seems to have taken over the center. That is the central substance and the central power structure of the BJP, and where the moderates, who have been, you know, maintaining a reasonable silence over all the killings and over all the actions, have been by and large isolated, including the Prime Minister, and the radicals or whether you can call them radicals or extremists or extremely right-wing, xenophobic, lunatic fringe has come to occupy the main space. So this is going to be very, very difficult for the BJP also, because it might lead to strong conflicts within the party. But seeing the party as it is, I personally feel that the Sangh Parivar and this entire family of right-wing Hinduism, Hindutva, not Hinduism, because Hinduism is, they don't represent Hinduism. They represent a very, very strongly reactionary and a very sectarian and small fringe within the Hinduism. Well, and I personally feel that these people are they speak in very many languages, so as to confuse the people.
Well, Amit Sengupta, let me bring Sheba George into the conversation, who is in Gujarat right now in the largest city, Ahmedabad. Sheba George, director of Sarwaru, a women's action organization. Can you talk about your response? And did this landslide surprise you? What does it mean for Gujarat and particularly for women? Hi.
Hi. Hello. It's not very audible. Could you please come again louder?
I'm just asking your response to the landslide victory of BJP.
Yeah, to the landslide victory. I think the thing is, what has happened is finally that a whole section of society has rejected the horror that another section of society has undergone. So the biggest casualty really has been humanity. The point is that human rights and women's rights activists like us and groups who were working with the marginalized and oppressed sections have really tried to address their issues. And the fact is that whichever community the victims would have been, we would have been working for them. The point is this, that, to gain state power, we have done away with a few thousand people of a particular community. We have raped women. We have violated so many human rights, and today it stands that people, we are not in a position to speak up because of this landslide. The kind of fear and the kind of the kind of attack on making the Hindus feel vulnerable, making the Hindus feel that you in your own land do not have democratic rights or whatever, has tried to divide Indian Hindus from other sections of their own society. So it's like dividing, making two parts of one body. So the biggest casualty has been the citizenship, the equal citizenship of each individual of India. And for us, that has been the most tragic aspect of this landslide victory.
Can you talk about your work with rape victims after the riots?
Yeah, as Seher Veru really means a new morning in women's lives. And we have been working really with marginalized groups here, like I was telling you. And in the last 10 months, we have been dealing with the victims of really horrific violence. And in the last 10 months, we were hopeful that still there would be some kind of justice for reconciliation and peace to be lasting. We did realize that these minority women, Muslim minorities, and the men from those areas should be given some sense of justice, and reinstating some of their faith in the constitution of the country, the legal systems of the country. And as human rights and women's rights activists, we have been trying to see that through the Indian legal systems, somewhere that some justice would come to them. Today we are really very doubtful if any of these commissions or tribunals or any cases will see the light of the day in terms of justice for them. So that is really also disturbing us. But otherwise, we do feel that women were healing, women were reconciling, women were wanting to continue, and the Muslim minorities are wanting to feel part of this nation, and Indian Muslims have never seen themselves as apart. But this kind of landslide victory for the Hindu right has definitely saddened the minorities in Gujarat and probably hurt them, which is something that has to be, worked on in future healing efforts by groups that are engaging with civil society.
Well, Sheba George, I want to thank you for being with us from Gujarat, and Amit Sengupta from the Hindustan Times talking to us from Delhi. We're going to turn now to an interview that Miranda Kennedy did with Ella Gandhi, the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi, who is from Gujarat. Of course, Mahatma Gandhi, the hero of secular and independent India. Ella Gandhi is a member of the ANC Parliament in South Africa and a member of the World Conference on Religion and Peace. She lives in Durban, but last week she came back to Gujarat, the state where her grandfather was born, to raise her voice against the religious violence that swept the state 9 months ago. This is what she had to say.
Since my childhood, I remember that we practiced the Gandhian style of observing our religion. Gandhiji wanted to get away from all the outer symbols of religion, like the buildings and things like that. And so his prayers were held outside in the open. They used to say the prayers in all the different religions. And in our home, we did the same. We had no problem in saying the Lord's Prayer, we had no problem in reciting a Muslim prayer and a Hindu prayer. So for me, when people are killed in the name of religion, I just cannot understand that. It's extremely painful, especially when it happens in a place where my grandfather was born. And it indicates that, you know, there are a lot of people still who haven't been influenced by his teachings. Gandhiji's message was very clear that we must use the ways of nonviolence. Unless we in the world, you know, look at the importance of his message to humanity, the world is on a collision course.
Well, dozens of human rights reports have shown that fundamentalist Hindu elements were involved in the violence of last spring in Gujarat, and many believe that the over 2,000 people, mostly Muslims, who were killed at the hands of religious Hindu groups, and that Gujarat's BJP government sponsored the killings. So what is your response to this happening in the state where your grandfather was born and where he advocated nonviolent solutions to creating a secular India?
I've just been reading the testimony given to the commission that was established, and I'm really horrified. And that testimony has been taken by impartial judges. And so one has to believe what you read there. And when you read the, you know, involvement of religious groups, the BJP involvement as well, in the sense that they didn't step in to curb it. They allowed it to go on, and that has to be condemned. I want to tell you that in Delhi, we attended a conference looking at the creation of a nonviolent peace force. They were all people who had suffered tremendous violence in their lives. People from Palestine, people from Israel, whose relatives have been killed, people whose relatives were killed in the September 11th attack in the U.S., all of them are saying, we don't want violence. The families of the victims in the U.S. are saying, not in our names. So we here need to also say that the violence has to be stopped. We can, you know, change the government, we can change people's mindset. So it's up to the people. The people have to speak up. They can't remain silent.
And that was Ella Gandhi, the granddaughter of Mahatma Gandhi. She is a member of the ANC, member of the parliament in South Africa, returned to her grandfather's birthplace in Gujarat last week to speak out against the violence. Again, the latest news, the votes have been counted, and the BJP has won a landslide victory in Gujarat, the ruling Hindu Nationalist Party. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about Iraq. We'll be joined by Dilip Hero, the writer and author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Stay with us. The Second Baghdad, Rahim Alhaj, here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. George W. Bush could succeed where Osama bin Laden failed in provoking a clash of civilizations between Islam and the West by launching a preemptive attack on Iraq. These are some of the concluding words of De La Pira in his latest book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm. Author of more than a dozen books on the Middle East, De La Pira writes regularly for The Observer, The Guardian, The Washington Post, The Nation, and is a frequent commentator on CNN, BBC, and various other U.S. and British radio television channels. He joins us today in our Firehouse studios. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's very good to have you with us. I wanted to start off where you just came from, London, where there was a meeting this weekend of more than 300 opposition leaders. According to Cameron Barr and the Christian Science Monitor, the Iraqi opposition leaders who gathered in London broadly agree on two things. Saddam Hussein must go, and the U.S., should its forces topple the Iraqi president, must rapidly follow him out. The U.S. is funding the Iraqi opposition, has worked to bring the fractious exiles together, and may be the main engine of Saddam Hussein's downfall. But opposition leaders dread the prospect of a lingering U.S. presence in what they call a liberated Iraq. Your response to that?
Well, I think it's quite simply, you see, when it comes to this kind of a thing, the puppet master is what counts, not the puppets. The whole thing is funded by the U.S. Everybody knows that. And I will give you a quote, which is in today's New York Times. A highly placed American observer at this particular conference in London said, in quote, more than 80% of these guys will have no place in post-Saddam government. His words. I would like to add to that 80% another 19% and make it 99%. Essentially, this is the PR job being done by the U.S. to try and show to the American public that politically we have the support of all the diverse elements opposed to Saddam Hussein. But ultimately, this means nothing at all because, you know the statement, the power flows from the barrel of the gun. And who has the gun? The Pentagon has the gun. And once the Pentagon goes in and does whatever it does, then it will dictate what happens after this. All these guys are, in one word, puppets.
Last night there was a piece on 60 Minutes about whether oil is at the heart of all of this, and there was an interview with Ahmed Chalabi, who is the head of the Iraqi National Congress. Interestingly enough, there's also an interview with James Woolsey, not mentioning that his law firm represents the Iraqi National Congress. Ahmed Chalabi was talking about how the oil companies basically better watch out now because they'll be deciding, they'll be getting rid of all the contracts that Saddam Hussein has signed off on. And yes, U.S. companies he is meeting with and talking to about their relationship with a new post-Saddam Iraq. Can you talk about who Chalabi is and his criminal record?
Mr. Ahmed Chalabi left Iraq when he was exactly 13 years old, 1-3, and he has not been to what is proper Iraq. For some years, he was in Kurdistan, and after the attempt by them to overthrow Saddam from Kurdistan failed, he is persona non grata in Kurdistan itself. As for his background, it's widely known. I mean, there's a book by the Coben brothers. They say he had set up a bank in Amman in 1989. The bank failed, and it is said that he had to flee. And in his absence, he was tried on two counts, and he was found guilty and given prison sentence of 3 and 6 years, and some people say 3 and 22 years. How much he knows about Iraq, I probably know much better than him, because I have spent some time in Iraq in about 2 years ago. And now, in about the oil, it's very simple. In fact, I have done a long piece, the op-ed for The Nation, which is going out today on their website. And I go into this. Let's just remember this. Mr. Chavez, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Of course, when he was campaigning, he said all these contracts in Venezuela are so much against Venezuelan interest that when I get to power, I'm going to throw them out. So has he thrown them out? You know, so it's very easily said that, you know, whatever is done, you know, because if I, as a puppet of the USA, come to power, then all these things will be thrown away. It is simply not done, you know. And the Saddam's government has given out contracts to 28 countries, 30 contracts, all the way from Russia, France, China, India, Vietnam, Italy, Spain. And you think all those...
Although now they have canceled their contracts with the Russian companies because Putin has sided with the United States.
No, I think partly because, see, what was happening, that Lukoil had signed a contract in March of 97. That contract was actually endorsed by the parliament itself. But that contract requires Lukoil to start exploring oil within a particular time frame, which they did not do. And therefore, on technical grounds, they have said this is off. Of course, a political reason. But if you take the big picture, 30 contracts, which are worth hundreds of billions of dollars, anybody think that all those oil companies, all the way from Russia, China, India, and Vietnam, and Spain, and Italy, are just going to go to sleep so that Mr. Shalabi can keep his word that he has given? I mean, it's a joke.
We're talking to De La Pirro. He is author of Iraq in the Eye of the Storm and also another book called War Without End, The Rise of Islamist Terrorism and Global Response. Your book, Iraq in the Eye of the Storm, goes extensively into Iraq's history and also the U.S. relationship with it. Right now, you talk about, in a recent piece you did for The Guardian, you talk about the most common used description of Saddam Hussein when they want to demonize him is talking about the man who gassed his own people.
Sure. Of course, I mean, this happened in 1988, March 1988, and it had to do with Saddam's government trying to seize back the liberated area of the Kurdish region, which had been liberated by the Kurdish parties working in alliance with the Iraqi enemy of Iran, when Iran and Iraq were at war. When he used those particular weapons in March 1988, Mr. Schultz, George Schultz, he was the U.S. Secretary of State, and his British counterpart, Jeffrey Howe, they said, yes, there is evidence that chemical weapons have been used, but the evidence is not, in quote, conclusive. Ah, that means the U.S. and the U.K. knew he was using chemical weapons. Saddam started using chemical weapons in October 1983. And do you know what? A gentleman who is doing a book on U.S. and Iraq relations has discovered through his research that President Reagan's ambassador to the Middle East, a gentleman called Donald Rumsfeld, went with a letter from Mr. Reagan, had a meeting with Saddam Hussein, who was notorious even in those days for eating babies for breakfast, and had a meeting with Tariq Aziz, and they discussed oil. They did not talk about chemical weapons which had been used just 2 months before. You know, and Saddam used these chemical weapons very extensively in 1988 to retake the areas he had lost to Iran. It's widely known. In FAO, in February 1986, there was a story done by Patrick Tyler of the New York Times, 18th of August of this year, in which he said, when Iraqi troops retook their Fao Peninsula from the Iranians. They had used chemical weapons, and there were two officers from the Defense Intelligence Agency. They went there after 2 days and found some parts of that particular operation had been sealed off because chemical weapons had been used. So the Americans and the British have known about the chemical weapons being used widely during Iran-Iraq war, then against the Kurds, and that happened March 1988. Amnesia for 14 years, and now, oh my God, this guy is using gas against his own people. But, you know, these chemical things that come in, how did Saddam get it? He got them from Germany. The German firms was selling chemical equipment for, in quote, pesticide. And this was done through the Turkish intermediaries. So is any, you know, this 12,000-page report that has been given by Saddam, you know what's being done right now? It's being cleaned up. Because in that report, Saddam has given the complete list of the European and the American company to supply these things out of which he made WMD. And this is all going
weapons
to be
mass
censored.
Destruction. Wait, let's talk about that for a minute. The 12,000-page report that Saddam Hussein has sent to the United Nations, supposed to go to the permanent UN Security Council members, came to the U.S. Two suitcases. Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, had just been to the country of Colombia, made a promise of something like $200 million to Colombia. And the head of the UN Security Council right now, the current president, is the Colombian ambassador. And he allows the U.S. to take the only copy that was sent to the United Nations in New York to Washington before anyone else saw it because they say they can do the Xeroxing better?
No, of course, I think the UN ran out of Xerox papers. Okay, and of course, let me put it this way. This is, to put it simply, hijacking. One difference, the hijackers paid $200 million. Now, you can work it out. Take $200 million, divide by 12,000 per page. My God, it's about each page is worth $1,000. And the Xerox copy only costs you 5 cents anyway. So I think point is very simple. When something is being done for American interest, the American interest can go as far as the tip of my nose. And out of that grows something 10 years, 20 years later on, which is much bigger. You can go back to, you said, my book, War Without End. Mr. Bin Laden, he was in bed with the CIA. Everybody knows that. So they solved the immediate problem, got the Soviets out of Afghanistan in 1989. And in year 2001, we know what happened. So you see, this is one of the criticisms or analysis that I give in all my books in the Middle East. Please, if you're trying to solve a problem, don't get so hung up to solve it immediately and in the process create much bigger problems which will mature 10, 15 years from now. And that is exactly if Mr. Bush goes to go in for this strike against Iraq, that's what's going to happen. And I'll give you one simple story. I'm sure you probably heard that one. You know the story about the operating surgeon? He goes into the theater. He comes out and he says to the relatives of the patient, operation successful, patient died. And this is exactly what is going to happen if Bush goes into Iraq. He will create more problems than will be solved. And at the same time, we have to remember all these Shalabi types, they are just puppets. They have no use. And America has its own game plan, and they are not going to put all this money and all the ground forces and suffering that will come to the American people and their military establishment, and then have these jokers, you know, failed bankers, to come around and run the country for them. Absolutely not.
In your book, Iraq and the Eye of the Storm, you talk about Iraq and the region. And in War Without End, you talk specifically, extensively about Saudi Arabia. Can you talk about Saudi Arabia right now?
Absolutely. Saudi Arabia, since established in 1932, has been in bed with USA from day one. Saudi Arabia, from 1932, has always been the fundamentalist state. The definition of fundamentalist state is very simple. If you are running your country 100% based on the Sharia, that is the Quran and the sayings and doings of the Prophet Muhammad, then you are a fundamentalist state. Do you know, I published a book in 1989, Holy Wars, and the chapter on Saudi Arabia says, Saudi Arabia, the oldest fundamentalist state in the world. I'll have to say, all these guys at the State Department, the National Security Council, I'm afraid they're very slow readers. If only they should have picked up my book in 1989. The oldest fundamentalist state in the world is Saudi Arabia. And now they've woken up. Oh, my God. 15 out of 19. And then they
15 out of 19 of the hijackers are from Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, and therefore they're so bad. And, oh, my God, look at the education they are giving. It's very intolerant. You know why is that happened? Because Saudi Arabia was politically on the defensive in the days of Nasser in the late 50s, early 60s.
Nasser as head of
and
Egypt.
Nasser as the head of Egypt, who were the nationalists, Arab nationalists, and later on it was under political attack from this mad mullah called Ayatollah Khomeini. And how did they, the rulers of Saudi Arabia, try to defend themselves? They increased the input of Islam into their education, working in conjunction with the USA. So you see, go to Afghanistan. What was the game plan of Afghanistan? If you, let's say that you joined up as a mujahid, not an Afghan, non-Afghan, or Afghan. You were, you know, they were using the Marines, U.S. Marines manual to train them. And they were translated into Persian and Urdu, etc., etc. Okay. Secondly, with your weapons training, you also had political training. What were the political training? Islam plus nationalism versus Soviets who are non-Afghans and they are atheists. Now, all these people were, shall I say, had heightened consciousness of political consciousness. They fought the Soviet imperialism in Afghanistan and they won. When they went back home to Egypt, when they went back to Saudi Arabia, their political consciousness told them, my God, my country, Egypt, is a colony of U.S. imperialism. And so they applied the same consciousness. Plus, here is the irony. They used the technique they were taught by the CIA in conjunction with its puppet, Pakistan. So you see, what I'm trying to say is very simple. It's okay. There's a problem to be solved. Soviets out of Afghanistan by every means. But in the process, the bigger problems have arrived. And if you are sensible as a human being, if you have something in your gray matter to learn from the past, have historical memory, then you should not make a big mistake, the kind of mistake you made before. And if Bush goes into Iraq, I can tell you the Iraqi, what comes out of that will be with us for the next 50 years.
Dilapiro, I want to thank you for being with us. Iraq in the Eye of the Storm is his latest book, a report from the inside by one of the world's leading authorities on the Middle East, and also War Without End. That does it for today's program. You can go to our website for more information at www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, and Anthony Sloan is our music maestro. Great to see him back in our studio. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!